Doug Stone. Let me tell you a little bit about his background. So I found out last night that Doug's first degree was actually in social studies at Harvard. But then he got a Rhodes Scholarship and went to Oxford, where he studied physics and philosophy. And then he decided to become a bit more practical and go into theoretical physics and started out as a condensed matter physicist. So he did his PhD at MIT, and then after some postdocs landed as a faculty at Yale, where he still is today. And Doug is now the deputy director of the Yale Quantum Institute. So as I said, although he started his career in condensed matter physics, he's been interested in a wide variety of topics. So he's worked in laser physics, nonlinear optics, quantum optics, chaos theory, and most recently he's become interested in quantum measurement theory and quantum computing. And then especially pertinent for today's talk is that back in, I think it was 2013?
Yeah,
2013, he published a popular science book called Einstein and the Quantum. It's a really excellent book, which I recommend to you, and it gives you a really insightful perspective on the history of quantum physics, sort of through the lens of Einstein's contributions, and really, for me, emphasized how Einstein really doesn't get enough credit for some of the central concepts in quantum theory, and also it emphasized that Einstein was really, in the very early days of quantum theory, the main driving force towards the quantum revolution. So I like Doug's book so much, I thought it would be nice to have him come here and tell us a little bit about the history of quantum theory and Einstein's involvement, and so he kindly agreed to do that for us.
Great. Well, thank you, Rob, and thanks for inviting me, and I haven't been here before, and it's a very impressive place, and nice to experience it. Also, I will comment that I had this prehistory as a humanist and then a philosopher and so on. And that inculcated in me a real desire to communicate and to express the excitement of science, which I couldn't quench for 25 years with my nose to the grindstone, doing research and running my department and stuff like that. So it was just very fortuitous that I got some insight into Einstein's contributions and decided that this was my way to communicate generally the excitement of physics to the general audience. So this book has very few equations and is for general audiences, but I'm happy to see so many physicists have enjoyed and learned things from it according to their report anyway. Okay, so so the famous thing about quantum Einstein and quantum mechanics is this viewpoint. He said in 1926, quantum mechanics is very impressive, but an inner voice tells me it's not yet the true Jacob. The theory produces a good deal, but hardly brings us closer to the secrets of the old one. I am at all events convinced that he does not play dice. So I will tell you a little more later about the context of that paragraph. He told his friend Otto Stern. That's the famous point of view that Einstein rejected quantum mechanics after having some early involvement and spent most of his life opposing it. But he also told his close friend Otto Stern that he had thought 100 times more about the quantum problems than about relativity theory. And Max Born said that Einstein would be one of the greatest theoretical physicists of all time if he hadn't written a single line about relativity. And Einstein himself said in 1908 that this quantum question is so enormously important that everyone should be working on it, which is interesting because there was almost no one working on it. You know, me could count him and then fractions of a few other people in the world were working on it. And finally, even much later, after general relativity, he said, The other great problem that I've concerned myself with since 1900 is that of radiation and the quantum theory. I've helped create the complex of ideas known by the name of quantum theory. I shall probably devote the rest of my life to the clarification of this problem, however slight the prospects for attaining the goal may be. And that's interesting because, in some sense, the goal was very close at that point. 25, Heisenberg started with matrix mechanics and Schrodinger in early 26. But, of course, Einstein didn't ever accept that as the final answer. Now, it may be strange to seem to worry about this guy getting credit, but still, you know, history is history, and we should try to be fair. So yes, at least this guy deserves more credit. The old sage guy gets lots of credit. Now, I'm not a professional historian, so I want to emphasize that I wrote a work of synthetic history and biography based on the work of both the published Einstein collected papers and by reading the work of other distinguished historians of science, such as those listed here. And so eventually I ended up with this, what do we call, a synthetic history biography and popular science book. Now, one of the main motivations for making this a popular science book was not just to give Einstein more credit, but also I think there's a lot of, there's a lack of appreciation of how significant quantum theory is because people do associate it with, somehow with black holes and the Higgs and not much in between. So I don't have to probably tell you guys that quantum mechanics is why we can make transistors, which are actually 10 times smaller than this one. And this old one in the 1930s was, you know, human scale. So all of the modern electronics and optics that revolutionized the 20th century, it's because we understand the atom. And so this was a turning point in human civilization, and it's important to understand the history of ideas that led to this. So let me just tell those of you, give you the short, quick summary of Einstein's scientific timeline before we start to review his accomplishments. So from 1902 to 1905, he was a patent clerk. There was the miracle year of 1905, where he did special relativity, E equals MC squared, Brownian motion, and also the paper on quanta of light that I'm going to talk about in this talk, which was the beginning of his work in quantum theory. Then for the next 2 years, he continued working primarily on quantum theory and really nailing down concepts that were not previously touched by Planck. He also came up with the equivalence principle, which was the seed of GR, still at the patent office. Eventually, he manages to get an academic job in 1909 at the University of Zurich and then moves to Prague. And here he works unsuccessfully on a quantum theory of radiation, but affirms through some results the necessity of wave-particle duality in the description of light. And I'm going to tell you a little more about that. He briefly comes back to work at his alma mater, ETH Zurich, from 1911 to 13, and starts working on general relativity, as a lot of people here know a lot more than me about that. And then after successfully coming up with the theory of general relativity, he returns to quantum theory, doing this fundamental work on the quantum theory of radiation, which I'll review, as well as doing some other minor things like gravitational waves and cosmology, stuff like that. Actually, for a few years, he gets distracted and travels the world, and the Eclipse expedition confirms general relativity, so he becomes a worldwide celebrity and begins searching for the unified field theory. But then in 1924 and 25, he comes back to quantum theory and does the quantum theory of the ideal gas and Einstein-Bose condensation. And then in the next period, the eventual form of non-relativistic quantum mechanics emerges. He rejects it, there's the famous Salve debates, but then, and he begins to formulate ideas about that lead to the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper and the concept of quantum entanglement, which has turned out to be incredibly important in modern quantum theory. So I underlined 8 seminal ideas in quantum theory that if 8 different people did them, they'd probably all get the Nobel Prize. And that's not counting, of course, relativity. So did pretty well. Okay, now let me tell you a little bit about his biography as well. So he was born in 1879 in Ulm, Germany, and he was born to a middle-class Jewish family that was not religious. He had relatives who were electrical engineers, and he had some exposure to physics at a young age. He was an excellent student, contrary to some mythology, but he was perceived as arrogant and actually dropped out of his elite German high school when he was 14. In one of the classes at this school, in Latin class, he was told by Herr Dagenhart, the professor there, that he must leave the room. And he said to Dagenhart, "But I have said nothing." And Dagenhart replied, "Your mere presence in the classroom undermines the respect of the other teachers for me." Students for me. So he was doing something. He was radiating some know-it-all attitudes. What happened was his parents had moved to Italy, even though he grew up in Germany, and he shows up on their doorstep, having dropped out of school without their knowledge, and they're understandably upset, but he says he's going to teach himself enough physics and math to get into this Zurich Polytechnic, which will accept you without a high school degree. And he indeed does that, and he goes and he takes the entrance exams for the Zurich Polytechnic and does extremely well in math and physics, but not so well in French and history. And so he fails, they won't accept him, but they tell him that he's only 16 and a half, they tell him, if you go to this high school in the nearby village of Harau and do well there, then we'll accept you. And so he spends one more year and then gets accepted into the physics section. And he very much impresses the head of the physics section, Heinrich Weber. In his first 2 years, he's the top student in his class. But Weber is very traditional. He's an experimenter, and he doesn't believe in this newfangled stuff of kinetic theory or Maxwell's equations. And so he's not teaching that stuff. And Einstein gets frustrated, and he stops going to class, hangs out in cafes, teaches himself physics. And when he does go to class, he kind of upsets the other professors, too. And so one story that I particularly like as a professor is that in the experimental lab class, they handed out, just like we do now, they give you a handout that tells you how to do the experiment you're supposed to do. And Einstein would take the handout and just walk over to the, to the wastebasket and throw it in the wastebasket without looking at it. And then he would try to do the experiment himself. He caused an explosion in the class, injured his hand, and got an F and was put on academic probation. So I think some of this was not the horrible, oppressive educational system. Some of this was Einstein, too, being, say, a certain kind of person. Okay, so because of this, when he finally squeaks by and passes the final exams, he asks Weber for an assistant's position with the idea that he'll get into some kind of academic track. This was called Privatdozent back then. And Weber says, "No, actually, I'm not really going to hire you. You're a pain in the whatever." So he doesn't say that. I don't know what he says, but he doesn't hire Einstein. He hires 2 engineering students instead of Einstein. So then he goes through a period where he's really, really doesn't have a job, and he's doing part-time jobs and ekes out a living. But although he had actually alienated the professors at Zurich Polytechnic. He was very popular with his fellow students. And one of them, Marcel Grossman, was the top student, later became a professor at Zurich. And he told his father on the first week of class that he had met this young man, Albert Einstein, who one day will be a very great man. So after 2 years of him being in the wilderness, Grossman's father gets him this job at the patent office. So that's how he can now earn a living. Now, during this time, he meets a fellow student, Mileva Maric, who's the only woman in the physics section and was a very talented student herself. But she did not succeed in passing the degree exams, and there's some sad details about that I'm not going to go into here. So she did not go on in physics, but they got married in 1902, I think, roughly. Okay. So now from 1902 and 1905, he's working 6 days a week in the patent office, but he's also working on physics. And he publishes several papers on the foundations of statistical mechanics, which are very similar to those of J.W. Gibbs. And he didn't know about those papers. So he was reproducing some foundational work in StatMech on his own. And at the same time, he formed this little group of intellectual friends that they called humorously the Olympia Academy to make fun of the pompous academies that Einstein later became a member of. And they would discuss philosophy, literature, and science. Through all this, he was very cheerful. He said, I have no talent whatsoever for melancholic moods. And if you read his letters, they're very charming. And he used to sometimes refer to himself as the valiant Swabian, who is a mythical figure in the history of Swabia, a crusader knight who defeated hundreds of Saracens in the Crusades through cleverness. And there was an epic poem about him. And so Einstein would sometimes tease Mileva by calling himself the valiant Swabian. This is where in some talks I put on the Indiana Jones theme song, but I'll skip. It's in there. It's one of the hidden slides. So anyway, here's a picture of Einstein at age 18 as a student, and then as a young father with Hans Albert, his first son, and Mileva in 1904. And this is the Olympia Academy. Besso was his close friend and relative through marriage. Solovine was a philosophy student who was one of the first members. And then Habicht was this mathematics student who did not remain a lifelong friend of Einstein's, but they had a very jocular and jovial relationship, insulting each other in the Olympia Academy, which I go through a little bit in my book. And it's interesting. And the reason that he is still known to history, Mr. Habicht, was that Einstein wrote him a letter in the spring of 1905, the miracle year. Here's a copy of the letter, and it begins, here's how it begins. Dear Habicht, such a solemn, so Habicht has moved away, and he doesn't know what Einstein has been doing. So Einstein writes him, Dear Habicht, such a solemn air of silence has descended between us that I almost feel as if I'm committing a sacrilege when I break it now with some inconsequential babble. Okay. And then he says to Habicht, so what are you up to? You smoked, canned, dried piece of a human being? Why haven't you sent me your thesis? Don't you know I'm one of the 1.5 people on Earth that would actually read it? So that's kind of how they talk to each other. And then he continues, so I promise you, if you send me your thesis, I promise you 4 papers in return. The first deals with radiation and the energy properties of light. It's very revolutionary. The 4th study is still a mere concept, the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies by the Use of a Modification of the Theory of Space and Time. Now, I actually think that Habib might have started to worry about his friend a little bit when he says modification theory, but who knows? We don't know what his response was, what he got. Anyway, these papers all appeared, three of them appeared in this famous issue of Annalen der Physik, and the theory editor was Max Planck, and this began Einstein's long kind of interaction with Planck, who apparently accepted these revolutionary papers and loved relativity, as we may get a chance to hear. But it wasn't relativity that Einstein said was very revolutionary. It was this one on the energy properties of light. So we're going to come back to that. So first, we need to circle back a little bit and talk about black body radiation. So in physics, we discuss a perfect black body that absorbs all radiation incident on it, and then emits it at some range of frequencies, assuming it's in thermal equilibrium. And there's some universal function, rho of nu and t, which is the black body energy density, which in 1860 already Gustav Kirchhoff had said was incredibly important to determine. Now, the modern point of view on the black body law is that it's just a photon gas in thermal equilibrium. And so we can just figure out what rho of nu and t is by saying, well, each photon has energy h nu. There's a certain equilibrium average number of photons with frequency nu at temperature t in equilibrium. And then we just, so that's energy per photon. That's the number of photons for each state. And then how many states are there, all of which have frequency nu? This is just a counting factor of a particle in a box-like state. And then the polarization or spin gives a factor of 2. Put that all together, and using the fact that the wave vector is related to the frequency in this way, and you get this formula for the black body radiation law. And it has two interesting limits. So if h nu is large compared to kt, then you get this exponential law known as Wien's law. And this is valid at optical frequencies on the Earth's surface. And if kt is much bigger than h nu, then you get what's called the Rayleigh or Rayleigh-Jeans law, which we'll come back to in a minute. And that's valid at far infrared frequencies and thermal equilibrium on the Earth's surface. Okay, that's a good approximation, not valid. And this is what the law looks like, choosing the most famous black body spectrum. Certainly here, I don't have to identify this, but it's the microwave background radiation. So quantum begins trying to explain that law. This is Wilhelm Wien, this is Planck, by 1896, Wien had proposed this form for the radiation law. Because it was easy to measure at fairly high frequencies, there was pretty good agreement at that point. And Max Planck went ahead to try to derive this, and in 1899, he claimed to have succeeded. So he says, he does some derivation that I won't go into, but I can tell you about if you're interested. And he says, it must therefore be concluded that the Wien distribution law for energy is a necessary consequence of electromagnetic theory and thermodynamics, and that the limits of the validity of this law coincide with those of the second law of thermodynamics. That's bad, right? Because that's really supposed to be unbreakable, right? Second law can't be broken. So he was committed. So this led to a very interesting and awkward situation, because only about 6 months later, he had this friend, Kurlbaum, who had done new experiments. And here, this is the data. What they're plotting is data at fixed wavelength as a function of temperature of rho. So if you remember from the Rayleigh law, this is the approximation to the Planck formula gives you a linear law proportional to kt for this. And if you plot Wien's law on the same plot, it doesn't agree at all. So there was now, just 6 months later, kind of totally unimpeachable experimental disconfirmation of Wien's law. And he had just said 6 months earlier that it was, you know, a fundamental law of nature. So that was awkward. In fact, I would say it's a theorist's worst nightmare. So it's interesting. You can read the proceedings from October 1900 in translation for me. And he says, the interesting results of long wavelength spectral energy measurements confirm the statement that Wien's energy distribution is not generally valid. And since I myself, even in this society, have expressed the opinion that Wien's law must necessarily be true, I may perhaps be permitted to explain briefly the relationship between the theory developed by me and the experimental data. So again, there's some hemming and hawing, you know? He doesn't say, gee, I'm clearly wrong and I apologize. But he eventually gets to this funny point where he says, I have finally started to construct completely arbitrary expressions for the entropy. I was especially attracted by one of the expressions, which is nearly as simple as Wien's and deserves to be investigated. And it leads to this law, which is, of course, the form of the Planck law. So he guesses the correct answer, and guesses isn't quite right. He does some kind of Taylor expansion and sees what it gives. And, you know, it's a clever guess. But he admits it's just sort of fitting, right, at this point. Okay, so now actually it does fit perfectly. So now here's data with Planck, and I didn't highlight it, but Planck agrees with the experimental data with the new law very well, and you can extract these constants from that too as well. So, of course, he needs a theoretical justification, so he uses Boltzmann's relation, which he later had engraved on Boltzmann's tomb. So, and there's some interesting history about that, because you may think this is Boltzmann's constant, but it was actually Planck's constant for a long time until the other Planck's constant started to become famous. anyway, so he uses this counting of states that I hope most of you know, that you can, if you have some microscopic model, you can count the number of accessible states, multiply by k times the log of that, and you'll get an expression for the entropy. And in this case, he was able to do that as a function of energy. So in December, he returns to the Prussian Physical Society, and he's calculated the black body law from the entropy of what he calls resonators, charged harmonic oscillators which emit radiation, by using quantization of energy, epsilon equals an integer times some new constant of nature, h, times the frequency. Okay, so he has derived it, and he says, we consider this the most essential part of the whole calculation. The total energy of the resonators is composed of a very definite number of equal parts, and use thereto the constant of nature, 6.55, blah, 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 which is very close to the modern value of Planck's constant. Okay, and as I said, that's the key idea. And he said later, what I did was simply an act of desperation. Anyway, so did he really believe that energy was quantized? This was the energy of his radiators, his hypothetical radiators. And there's a funny sentence in here, which I think really reveals he didn't think that energy was really quantized. He says, the constant H multiplied by the common frequency nu of the resonators gives us the energy element epsilon. And dividing the total energy E by epsilon, we get a number P of energy elements to be divided over the N resonators. If the ratio of P is not an integer, then we take for P an integer in the neighborhood. Well, obviously, if energy was really quantized in nature, then this P would always have to be an integer. So I think it's pretty clear from that and other historical information that he thought this was maybe a provisional hypothesis that could be eliminated. Now, when you do that, you can this is something we teach in, undergraduate stat mech. You can calculate as a function of this N and P what W is, and you can then get the entropy, and you can get the black body law. So that's what he did. So he did this revolutionary thing, so everybody was really upset. Well, not really, because nobody really commented on it at all. They were very excited that there was this Boltzmann constant, which was then called Planck's constant K, that you could extract. And they used that to figure out Avogadro's number. But nobody really argued with him about this H guy. Nobody knew what it meant, except for one guy. So Einstein in 1905 came out with this first of the magic miracle papers, called On a Heuristic Point of View Concerning the Production and Transformation of Light. And it wasn't exactly a response to Planck. I have lots to say about it. Sort of was a response to Planck, but he got talked out of insulting Planck. Anyway, in this he says, in fact, it seems to me that the observations of black body radiation, the photoelectric effect, other phenomena involving the conversion of light can be better understood on the assumption that the energy of the light is distributed discontinuously in space, and that light consists of a finite number of energy quanta localized, which move without being divided and can be absorbed and emitted only as a whole. Okay, so Albrecht Folsing, who's one of the great biographers of Einstein, says this is the most revolutionary sentence written by a physicist of the 20th century. And he himself said it was very revolutionary. So why are they saying this? Well, the wave theory of light had vanquished any kind of particle theory at the beginning of the 19th century. And there's the famous experiments, Young's double slit. There's the spot of Arago, which is a diffraction experiment that I won't go into, but also proves interference of light. And of course, then Maxwell came along and found the wave equation. And this was sort of the standard model by 1905. There was a transformational technology based on this wave theory, radio. And Bohr used to make a joke that if any experiment confirmed Einstein's idea of light quanta, he would send him a telegram to disprove it. So, you know, it was like, there's nothing more to see here, okay? We know that the light's away. So, and there was, very little experimental evidence for some kind of particles, some kind of photons. We also don't know how he thought of it. Somehow, 15,000 people asked him how he thought of relativity, and I haven't found anyone directly saying to him, what made you hypothesize this? So I haven't found that. If anybody knows of that. So what's in this paper? The very first thing in this paper is after the introduction where he says, I'm going to, postulate a quanta of light, is he says, it's called On a Difficulty Encountered in the Theory of Black Body Radiation. And here's some equations from the paper. So these resonators are harmonic oscillators in thermal equilibrium. So from the equipartition theorem, their energy for each resonator should be kT. He didn't know about K, so he called it R over N. R was the gas constant, and N is Avogadro's number. I mean, he knew about it, but it wasn't in common use. And there's this general equation for the energy density that you want in terms of the average energy of the emitting harmonic oscillator. And this is an L in this formula is what we now call C, the speed of light. And so with that, put those two together, and you get the Rayleigh-Jeans law, except there wasn't any Rayleigh-Jeans law then. And then he points out in a sort of awkward property of this equation, which is that it fails to agree with the experiment. It also states that in our model, a definite distribution of energy between ether and matter is out of the question. Because if you integrate over frequencies, it goes like nu squared. There's no cutoff in the Maxwell spectrum, so this is infinity. So he really wrote this equation. We don't usually write these. Well, maybe you guys do. This is infinite. So, Rob said we should call this a no-go theorem for classical physics, right? So Einstein, really had thought about this deeply, and he knew that there had to be a revolution to get away from this. This was the only thing that you could get from classical physics, and this gives an absurd implication, this infinity. And so there's just going to have to be new laws of something to get the black body law. And so that's why this paper is not called a theory or anything like that. He calls it a heuristic point of view because he knows he doesn't know the new laws yet. But he wants to try to figure out what kind of qualitative features they'll have. It's extremely brave. It's one of his first papers. He's not at all famous yet. But of course, he didn't care. So he I think that's why how he was motivated. And then he does several arguments before he gets to the photoelectric effect. He interprets the entropy of black body radiation in the Wien limit so that it looks exactly like, first I'll just mention this quote that he says that Planck's formula agrees with all experiments, but I'm only going to rely on the Wien limit here because that's the limit in which it looks like the gas consists of particles with energy H nu, that the entropy looks exactly like that of an ideal gas if we assume that the energy of the radiation divided by H nu is the number of particles. So that's the first argument he makes. Then he says, look, there's this phenomenon called Stokes' phenomenon that when matter absorbs light and re-emits, it always re-emits at a lower frequency than the incident light. And why shouldn't it occasionally emit at a higher frequency if the light is intense? Well, that can be explained by the fact that the energy per quanta of light goes like H nu. And then the most famous one is the analysis of the photoelectric effect. So the photoelectric effect you take a bright lamp and you divide it into its different frequencies or colors and then focus on a thin metal foil, which knocks electrons out, which are then collected by this collecting electrode, and you measure the photocurrent. Okay, so that's what the photoelectric effect is. And this had been studied by Philip Leonard and had seen qualitatively that that there was a cutoff frequency below which you could not get any photocurrent, no matter how intense your light was. So you could make the light more and more intense, and you still wouldn't get any red photocurrent for red light, only for violet and ultraviolet. So that was the thing that Einstein wanted to explain. And the way he explained it was that, well, instead of this being a wave being absorbed, let's think of it as a train of particles coming in. And it's very improbable that these quanta, that more than one will hit a bound electron at the same time. And so when it hits, it can only give one quantum of energy, which causes the thing to vibrate. But if the energy isn't high enough, it won't knock it out of the solid to be detected. And therefore, it depends only on the frequency and not on the intensity. Now, actually, with lasers, we can violate all this because we can make such intense light that you could have violated this, but he even has a footnote that kind of alludes to that. It's amazing. Didn't say anything about lasers, but he said that very improbable that two quanta would hit at the same time. Okay, so there was no good experimental test for 10 years of this idea, and the whole concept was widely dismissed by the physics community, really widely. But Einstein was not deterred. I'm going to come back to that story of what happened about quanta of light in a little bit. So the next thing he does...
Sorry, I don't understand.
Yeah.
There was an experiment, and then he explained it, but he said there was...
He did not have systematic data.
Okay.
That's and apparently it's extremely hard to measure to measure what you need to measure, which is actually the stopping voltage. So I'm going to come back to that. Yeah. Okay. So there was experiments motivating, and he even says at the end, unfortunately, the data is not good enough for me to really test my idea. And maybe this will happen soon. Okay. Now, in 1906, he decides that actually Planck's theory differs from Maxwell's theory precisely because Planck is implicitly using the hypothesis of light quanta. Planck doesn't agree with that and says, I'm not seeking the meaning of the quantum in the vacuum, but rather where absorption and emission takes place. And by the way, you did this amazing thing on relativity, and we really should be focusing on that. That literally is what he says. Not in those words, but I can tell you the exact words he says. So, so what does Einstein do in this paper? Well, he goes back to StatMech, and he now understands there's this thing called a partition function. And if you assume some Hamiltonian, which is just like a harmonic oscillator or a quadratic Hamiltonian, then you can prove that the average energy per degree of freedom has got to be kt. That's the equal partition theorem, kt for 2 degrees of freedom, kt over 2 per degree of freedom. But if you just take this integral and say that the energies are quantized and I have to do a sum, then you get the famous formula for the n bar that I used earlier, the mean number of quanta in thermal equilibrium, which is underlies the Planck law. Okay, so he understands that quantization is sort of key to getting this result. And that's T.S. Kuhn, the famous historian of science, says it's really Einstein that's announcing the birth of quantum theory here and then in the next paper, and not Planck. Okay.
So I have a silly question. Maybe you mentioned this. Where did this term quantum first appear?
That's a good question.
They're already using
it. Yeah, I think Planck definitely used it. Planck used it, yeah. 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 So, okay, so, okay, so the second place, first he just analyzes the black body law from this point of view and says, oh, this would make sense if there are quanta of light being absorbed. But then he actually goes to a new problem in the in the theory of heat, specifically specific heat. So, and in this paper that he comes out in 1907, he says something that's, you know, really, again, incredible. He says, for although one has thought that the motion of molecules obeys the same laws that hold for the motion of bodies in our world of sense perception, we must now assume that the diversity of states they can assume is less than for bodies within our experience. We have the additional assumption that the energy of elementary structures can only assume the values of energy 0, h nu, 2 h nu, et cetera. So now he's really saying there's a new atomic physics. It's not something to do with light or the interaction of light with matter, because it's part of the specific heat of solids, the main part for insulators, is due to the vibrations of the solids, which may or may not interact with it, with radiation. So this is now a hypothesis about mechanics that was not proposed by Planck. And this explains the deviation from the Dulong-Petit law, which basically assumes this equipartition result of kT over 2 per, or kT per harmonic oscillator. So the specific, if this is the average energy of n harmonic oscillators in 3 dimensions, according to this theory, I take the derivative and I'll get, if I look at the high temperature limit, I'll just get a constant for this derivative, which is the Dulong-Petit law. But if I look at the low temperature limit of this formula, it will deviate and the specific heat will go to 0. And that's exactly what Einstein then plotted in this paper. So this is Einstein comparing to experimental data. I don't think he drafted it himself, but he might have. And ironically, this was data for diamond. See, diamond being very hard, the frequencies of oscillation are very high, and that means you can measure a deviation at low temperature more easily because H nu becomes greater than kT. And this data was from his old nemesis, Heinrich Weber, interestingly. So he did learn something in that class. The person who was particularly excited about this was Walter Nernst. Walter Nernst was the biggest shot in German physics. He was both extremely wealthy and extremely important. He was the most influential physical scientist in Germany. And he had proposed that the entropy of everything should go to 0 as t goes to 0 and had some measurements of this kind of specific heat curve himself. And that became called the Nernst law or the third law of thermodynamics. So he had a big investment in this. And that doesn't happen within classical physics for this problem. So he was very excited, and he came and he visited Einstein, and then he wrote that Einstein's quantum hypothesis is probably the strangest thing ever thought up. If correct, it opens entirely new roads for molecular theory, and if it is wrong, it will remain a beautiful dream. So Nernst, the most important guy to impress, had become very impressed with Einstein. Okay, now in the meantime, after the specific heat work, Einstein thought, I've got to decide. Am I going to work on a quantum theory of atoms or am I going to work on a quantum theory of light? Well, I think he probably did some on both, but he never published anything on the quantum theory of atoms. He chooses to work on light, okay? And so he writes to Sommerfeld in January 1908, "I am pessimistic due to my endless vain efforts to interpret the universal constant H in Planck's law. I seriously doubt that it will be possible to maintain the general validity of Maxwell's equations." So that's what he thinks he should do. He should modify Maxwell's equations. And in 1909, he actually put this in writing, and he said, "The fundamental equation of optics will have to be replaced by an equation in which the charge E also appears. It cannot be linear and homogeneous. I have not yet succeeded in finding such a system of equations suitable for constructing the light quanta." So we want some nonlinear wave equation to describe light quanta. But it seems to me that this is going to be possible. The variety of possibilities does not seem so great for one to shrink from the task. But Lorentz, who was the greatest electrodynamicist possibly of all time, said, "As soon as one makes even the slightest change in Maxwell's equations, one is faced, I believe, with the greatest difficulties." So that's exactly right. So Einstein doesn't succeed in doing that. But in 1909, he finally gets to talk to other theoretical physicists or other physicists. That's a longer story, but because until he quit the patent office, he basically had no free time to go meet other physicists, and he'd never met a theoretical physicist really until 1909. So he gives this talk. He's invited by Planck, and he analyzes the momentum fluctuations arising from black body radiation acting on a mirror. So there's this mirror suspended in a cavity with black body radiation, which is hitting it, and through radiation pressure is tending to damp the oscillations of this mirror, which because of thermal fluctuations has kT, you know, of energy, which is then gonna be damped by its exposure to radiation. But so it's doing some fluctuations, and he does these first kinds of calculations where you balance the radiation, the damping force, the viscous force with the Langevin fluctuation force, and he gets this formula for the variance of the momentum of the mirror, and it has two terms. The first term is the momentum per photon times the density of photons. That's exactly what you would get for just pure particles with energy h nu. But then there's this other term, which goes like the square of the density, which is characteristic of fluctuations of waves. That's speckle in my world. So one is a particle term, one is a wave term, and can be derived classically. But he's derived it rigorously from the black body law, which includes quantum effects. So this is a valid equation in modern quantum electrodynamics. And in modern books, sometimes they write this as the variance of n is n, the average number times the average number squared. So in quantum optics, that's the version that's famously shown and attributed to Einstein. And then he says, "It is therefore my opinion that the next stage of development of theoretical physics will bring us a theory which can be regarded as a fusion of the wave theory and the emission, or what I would call particle theory." And as I said, this is this statistical derivation is rigorous, so this is a modernly valid equation, but he eventually agrees, "I don't have sufficient imagination to construct a theory just on this basis." So he gives up, okay? And he, so in 1909, he writes to his friend Laub, "The riddle of radiation will not yield," and he just gives up. And the problem is that Maxwell's equations actually are quantum equations for the average fields. There's H bar doesn't appear in them because the energy and the momentum both have an H in it, and it cancels on both sides of that equation. In Schrodinger's equation, that's not true, and we have an H squared because of the mass. So he couldn't put H in, and we now know that it's an exact equation. You have to look at the fluctuations of the field to see the presence of photons. And then he told his friend Besso, "I no longer ask if these quanta are real, nor do I try to construct them any longer, for I know my brain cannot get through in this way." So he really gives up. He gets very excited with relativity. Sommerfeld wrote to Hilbert that I can't get Einstein interested in quantum at all anymore. So he leaves the pursuit just of the quantum just as the community is understanding there's a crisis. So this is the famous Solvay Conference of 1911, the first Solvay Conference, the greatest, most illustrious group assembled in the history of physics. And you see Einstein there. And he talks about his theory of specific heat, but he says to his friend Besso, the conference resembled the lamentations on the ruins of Jerusalem. I did not find it very stimulating because I found nothing I did not know before. So he's ahead of everybody, but now he's gotten discouraged about finding the solution, and he moves to the easier problem of general relativity. okay, now just after that, Planck and Nernst convinced Einstein to come to work in Berlin and to leave Zurich, and they have to write a letter of recommendation for Einstein to the Prussian Academy so that he can be admitted at this absurdly young age. So they say how he's the new Galileo and so on, but they're honest in this letter. And so they do say that Einstein may sometimes have missed the target of his speculations, as for example, in his hypothesis of light quanta, cannot really be held against him. And they go on about how if you're a genius, you're gonna make mistakes and so on and so on. So now there's somebody interesting in this picture. Some people might know who that is, but we'll come back to who that fourth guy is, because he's going to be important. So Einstein hadn't learned anything from Solvay, but others had. Bohr, for example, he learned about it from Rutherford, who was at Solvay, and that's how he got started working on this. And I think I won't go through the Bohr atom, except there are orbits, and when an electron jumps between orbits, it emits energy H nu, according to the Einstein formula, but this is not a photon, okay? He does not say this is a photon. It's just a packet of energy, of radiation, classical radiation, that sums up to energy H nu. But it's not an indivisible thing, a new particle. Now, Einstein loved this Bohr's theory because it had this bold notion that the frequency of the emitted light was now detached from the frequency of the orbiting electron. And so he said it must be right, and I have more about that in my book. Okay, so back to this guy. So that's actually Robert Millikan. Some of you might have known that. And he was a great experimenter who was very interested in measuring electrons, right? He did the oil drop and or charges. Rather. So coming back to the photoelectric effect, he started to do very careful experiments. And in these experiments, I left out that they have this grid here which can be charged, and when the photoelectrons are coming through, you can charge this grid up negatively, and by charging it up negatively, you can turn off the photocurrent, right? Because you can put enough voltage here to make the, to rob the electron of the energy to reach the collector. And so from the stopping voltage, you can infer the energy per electron, and from conservation of energy, then you have that this stopping voltage should go linearly with slope h as a function of frequency. So that's the thing that was very hard to measure, apparently. I'm not an experimentalist. I don't know why it was so hard back then, but I guarantee you it was hard because he says he spent 10 years doing this. So here is the stopping voltage versus frequency. There's a nice straight line there, and he's kind of blown up his calculation here of what the slope of that line is, and you see it's 6.56 times 10 to the minus 27, which is Planck's constant. And it's very interesting to read what he says. I gotta read it here. We are confronted, however, by the astonishing situation that the facts correctly and exactly predicted 9 years ago by a form of quantum theory, which has been pretty generally abandoned, that Einstein brought forth this bold, not to say reckless, hypothesis of light corpuscles. This hypothesis may be called reckless first because an electromagnetic disturbance which remains localized in space seems a violation of the very conception of electromagnetic disturbance. And second, because it flies in the face of thoroughly established effects of interference. So that's why it was revolutionary. It seemed to just to totally fly in the face of it. So, and he says this in his paper. This is not a private, you know, comment.
Sorry, it's in that. I mean, he's picking on the localized in the space part, which says the waves cannot be localized in space. I mean, this is correct, right? So
that is correct, yes.
So that's not, I guess it's not, so that's the one bit that is, I guess, he's criticizing, and yeah, he's writing that, right?
Well, no interference, I would say, is, you know, it's very hard. I mean, obviously, there was no real concept of wave-particle duality, so anyway. We talk about it more. So after Bohr, Einstein came back and he had this splendid idea, and he actually called it splendid. He said to his friend Besso, "A splendid idea has dawned on me concerning absorption and emission of radiation, an amazingly simple derivation of Planck's formula. I am tempted to say the derivation, everything quite quantic." So now with the Bohr atom, you could say that what's going on is that when, you know, radiation comes in, some of it can be absorbed and it can excite the atom. Or you also can say it can actually drive the atom to emit when it's excited. So radiation, you know, is enhanced. That's stimulated emission when you have an inverted system. But then he also said there's a new thing that was not there before, and that's spontaneous emission. That's with no external radiation present, that the atom just spontaneously drops down to a lower energy state and emits. So that's the new thing, and that's the introduction of, well, first let me say that if you now balance these three processes and you absolutely need the spontaneous emission to get the right answer, then you can get Planck's radiation law. If you don't put that in, you won't get the right answer. Okay. And he also does a further argument to prove that the emission of photons is directional. And he says to Besso, the light quanta are as good as established as far as I am concerned. So this is when he comes back to really saying they're particles, they act like particles, they walk like particles, they quack like particles, whatever. Okay, but he does say that the weakness of the theory lies in the fact that it leaves the time and direction of the elementary processes to chance. Nevertheless, I have full confidence in the reliability of the course taken. And so Einstein is really the one introducing this intrinsic randomness into quantum theory, and he kept coming back to it and saying, well, this lack of causality is still bothering me. Okay. Now, at the same time, since he was thinking now about these emission processes, he started to develop an interpretation of how this could be, and he developed this idea of ghost waves, and I think people here, many would be familiar with the essentials of this idea. Now, he never wrote it down. I mean, there's some story that in 1927 he had a paper which he didn't quite publish, and I think is now somehow vaguely available. I'm not sure. But he talked about it a lot. And so in 1922, Lorentz wanted to use this, and he wrote to Einstein saying, so isn't this the basic idea that there's an interference radiation that's emitted, which occurs according to the normal laws of optics, but doesn't transfer energy. And then there's an energetic radiation composed of indivisible quanta, and they can't go where the interference radiation is zero. And after you emit many of them, you get the classical result, and so on, which is very much then this idea of a guiding, you know, of a what do they call it, guiding wave type view. Now, Born interpreted it as purely probabilistic later, and he introduced it for electron waves, and he wrote to Einstein in 1926, I'm entirely satisfied because my idea to look upon the Schrödinger wave function as a ghost field in your sense proves better all the time. Okay, so, but did anybody else believe in quantum light back in 1918 when Einstein was developing these ideas, which he never published? Well, as we know, Millikan didn't really believe in it. I can't really say this is a satisfactory theoretical foundation for the photoelectric law, but it certainly agrees very well with the behavior. And so the Nobel Committee decided to give him the Nobel Prize for his services to theoretical physics, none of which we will actually commit to, but especially for the discovery of the law of the photoelectric effect. So it's literally, there's this one law that you prove, that is now checked, and so we're giving it to you for that. There's no mention of quanta of light there, and in fact, it isn't until 1925 that the measurement of the Compton effect and its verification by Botha and Geiger leads to where, we have X-rays interacting with electrons and scattering, leads to the belief now in quanta of light by everybody. And I have this fun quote from Born's letter to Bohr. I was in Berlin the other day. Everyone was talking about the results of the Botha-Geiger experiment, which decided in favor of light quanta. Einstein was exultant. So finally, well after the Nobel Prize, this is finally accepted, and just on the cusp of the actual discovery of the Schrödinger equation and so on. So in 1924, the last thing, and I'll have to go through this a little faster since I'm a little behind, that I want to talk briefly about is that in 1924, he gets a letter from an unknown Indian physicist, Satchendranath Bose, who was saying he had written a paper deriving yet again Planck's formula. And the question was why are we still working on this? And the answer was, people felt like it should be treatable as a gas of quanta. You should be able to use Stitzel mechanics to do the counting and then get the quantum law without talking about resonators and atoms, et cetera. Okay, and all right. But if you treat it in the normal way, you will get Wien's law. You won't get the Planck law. Okay, so here's a translation of his paper. And there's a key step where he's counting states of quanta classically, but he makes some assumption about how many states there are. And this assumption is equivalent to saying that if I take photon 1 and interchange it with photon 2 in terms of its state, that I don't count that as a new state, okay? Which is how we do quantum counting now for identical particles. But he did it, but he didn't comment on it. He didn't say a word that this is what I'm doing. And he knew what answer he had to get, so he got the right answer. And many years later, he was honest enough to say, I had no idea that what I had done was really novel, that it was different from Boltzmann statistics. So this is an interesting episode. Well, so Einstein gets this, and he really immediately decides it must be right, which is surprising. And he says, Bose's formula signifies a significant advance, and I'll use this to do a quantum theory of the ideal gas. And I'll skip through this a little bit. It's a really fun story. Let me just say that eventually he understands it very, very well. And so he's able then to derive the phenomenon of Bose-Einstein condensation, Einstein condensation, because Bose never worked on massive particles. And he says in his 1925 paper that Bose statistics expresses an implicit hypothesis about the mutual influence of the molecules of a totally new and mysterious kind. So what is this influence? Well, I've got here two classical coins, and you all know that if I flip these and I ask what's the probability of getting one heads and one tails, it's going to be 2 out of 4, because there are 4 states, and there are 2 ways to get, so the probability we have, because there's 2 ways to get a heads and a tail. However, in Bose statistics, he just says that's not, there are no such 2 states. And that means that the states of the system where the 2 particles have been interchanged just doesn't ontologically exist. There's only 1 such state, okay? So it seems like the particles bunch, because the number of states where they were in different states is reduced, but the number of states where they're in the same state is not reduced for bosons. Okay, so that's the influence that Einstein had figured out. I'm going to come back to that in a second. Okay, now the story of Bose is that Einstein wrote a letter to his university and he's immediately granted a fellowship to come to Europe. He comes to France, he stays in France and kind of seems a little too shy to like go meet Einstein, even though Einstein has invited him for almost a year, but he finally goes, okay. Bose has no role in understanding BEC. By the time he meets Einstein, Heisenberg has come up with matrix mechanics, and Einstein suggests he work on that, but he doesn't make any progress. He goes back to India, not having achieved much on the visit. But he's, you know, very revered in India, but he'd made no further contribution to physics on the same scale. And he actually said, I was not really in science anymore. I was like a comet that came once and never returned. But all the force-carrying particles in modern physics are named after him, so he did well with his one transit. Okay, so now the last little anecdote I'm going to tell you is about two months later. You can see the date. It's February 28, 1925. Einstein has received a letter from Schrödinger telling him that he's done his counting wrong in his paper. And Einstein responds, your reproach is not unjustified, although I have not made a mistake in my paper. In the Bose statistics which I use, the quanta or molecules are not considered as mutually independent objects. Then he draws a little sketch, and this is what I love. this is my peak moment, right? Because this is exactly what I just did, right? I mean, here are the two coins with the four states, and then there's the quantum coins with only three states, and you can see Bose statistician and so on. So he explains to him about this weird counting that you have to do in quantum theory. Okay, so, and Schrödinger is blown away. He says, I'd not grasped it before at all, despite the fact that Bose's paper had already come out. Bose's work didn't seem particularly interesting to me. Only your theory of gas degeneracy is really something fundamentally new. So then he starts corresponding a lot with Schrödinger with Einstein, and there's some interesting connections between that and the emergence of the Schrödinger equation. Schrödinger and Heisenberg separately do it, and I won't go through any of that history, except to say that Schrödinger does say that Einstein influenced him very substantially. Now, Einstein, as we've seen at the beginning, says, yeah, it's very impressive, but I'm not convinced that God plays dice. And the interesting thing is he wrote that in response to the letter from Born, where he says, I'm using your idea of the ghost field. And Einstein is explicitly rejecting his old idea of the ghost field when he says God doesn't play dice for the first time, which is kind of fun. So, okay, so, and of course he didn't change his mind. He said, in his 70s, he said, all the 50 years of conscious brooding have brought me no closer to the answer to the question, what are light quanta? Of course, today, every rascal thinks he knows the answer, but he is deluding himself. So, very briefly, Einstein really had a very realist view of physics, and he says in his autobiographical notes, he went into physics because he didn't want to spend his life filling his belly, i.e. making money or whatever, worrying about material things. He wanted to glimpse eternal truths about nature. And he, as he expresses it here, that's what physics is about, independent of it being observed. So the thing he really didn't like about quantum mechanics was not its probabilistic nature, but the fact that the observer came into the story and there's a complicated boundary between what is true about the world and what we know to be true about the world, which we still struggle with to this day. So that's what he didn't like. And sometimes he would just say, do you really believe that the moon exists only if I'm looking at it, if you're looking at it? So this sort of rejection of his own creations struck me to be kind of a very interesting thing. So one of the ways he expressed this realism is a finely tempered nature longs to escape from the personal life into the world of objective perception and thought. So it's a little like the moment in the Ninth Symphony where the choral movement starts and the baritone sings "Nicht diese Töne," this is not my music. And so he's rejecting the earlier quantum harmonies for something that he hopes will be better. So thank you for your attention.
So we always start with questions from students. Are there any student questions? Any questions at all?
So you alluded to something sad that happened to Mileva and her figure.
About Mileva, yeah. So there are two things I learned. One was that I don't know about the first time she took it, but she got a 4.0, and 4.5 was passing. That's what Einstein got. And I talked to an ETH professor who said to me, you know, they could have passed her with a 4.0. That's one thing. Second thing is that she got a second chance to take it. And that was the year where she got pregnant. And there's this unknown, you know, this previously unknown child of Einstein's who's called Lee Zirl. You know, they were not married yet. And she went back to Serbia and she had the had the child and left the child in Serbia. So when she would have been studying to get her second chance, she, you know, was going through this very difficult process of having a baby out of wedlock and having to leave her baby. And so I think that would have made it incredibly hard for her to do well on the second shot. So.
I have a question. What's the story of how you got into writing this book? Was it the quantum chaos
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this. So there's a paper that doesn't quite make it into Einstein's greatest hits in 1917, which is called On the Quantum Condition of Sommerfeld and Epstein. And it's about Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization and how to do it in a more abstract way. And then he points out that this way that's better than what Bohr and Sommerfeld come up with still wouldn't work for random systems, for like stat-mech systems. And that's sort of the seed of the problem of quantum chaos, that you can't do a semi-classical expansion to find the energy levels of a quantum system that's classically chaotic. So you can't do a WKB type theory that will get you closer and closer to the energies. It's fundamentally not allowed because of, well, I can explain more about that. So Einstein wrote that paper, and then I wrote about that paper in the 100th anniversary of his miracle year, 2005. And then people asked me to talk about Einstein, and I didn't want to talk about this really technical, narrow thing that wasn't one of his greatest hits. So then I started to learn about, Kuhn's point of view and the true story of what happened with Planck, that he never embraced the idea of a revolutionary. And that sort of seemed like a very important thing in the history of ideas, that Einstein really is the founder of quantum mechanics in that first decade and the first person to realize there was going to be a revolution. And then he kept anticipating new developments almost up to the Schrodinger equation. So,
something that the historian community acknowledges, or
I think so. Yeah, I think if you look at the ones who are most noted for this, like Martin Klein and John Stachel and T.S. Kuhn, I think most people, yeah, do agree with that. Many fewer physicists agree with it. Yeah.
I think if he hadn't perhaps been distracted by general relativity, he might have gone all the way and come up with Schrodinger's equation or something equivalent. Was he conceptually blocked, do you think?
It seems to me that he was very fixated on the idea that you had to, would be a very relativity, an idea very similar to relativity, where Maxwell's equations would be a limit of a more general equation. And you would take the limit where something, I don't know, of high intensity or something, and you would get Maxwell's equations. And that's probably not the right way to get to quantum mechanics. So in that sense, but I think, on the other hand, I think that he understood entanglement before anybody and had a much deeper understanding of many body ideas in quantum mechanics than many people at the most people at the beginning. So I think he could have made great contributions to quantum mechanics after the Schrodinger equation if he said, I want to work on the many-body Schrodinger equation. He might well have made really great contributions there and discovered some of the things, you know, that now underlie quantum information theory.
You said at one point you had to make a decision between studying quantum theory of light or studying quantum theory of atoms. If he had turned to atoms, you think the story would have been different? Would it involve?
Well, I didn't get to say as much as I wanted to about this, so that's a really good question. See, I think the thing that's very radical about Bohr's theory is there's like no frequency to quantize, right? It's not a harmonic oscillator, and his quantization is very much of a kludge if you read his original paper. Basically, the frequency changes as the electron spirals in, and roughly speaking, if you take the average between the frequency of the inner and the outer orbit, and you quantize that, you get the answer, and that's what he says in his paper, but it's a total kludge, and therefore the frequency of the light emitted is not simply related to the period of rotation of the electron or even the mean period. So that's why Einstein said, you know, this is amazing. The energy of the electron has nothing to do with the frequency of the light. So I think that was and you remember how Einstein used to always talk about the great musicality of the spheres of Bohr. You know, he has this famous thing about he used the greatest musicality of the spheres to figure out his theory. I think he just thought that was, he wasn't willing to abandon the relationship between the frequency of the current that's driving the electromagnetic radiation and the frequency of the radiation. So that was where he was stuck, and he admitted that when he made that comment. You know, that's the best evidence we have to where he was stuck. So I don't know, but he claimed, you know, he may have had ideas about, who knows? Maybe he would have. I mean, the thing is, there is H in Schrodinger's equation. That's the point. So he might have had more luck finding that, because he was looking for an equation with H in it. And E, of course, there's E in Schrodinger's equation too. So.
Any further questions? Okay. Oh,
yes. Maybe. So you mentioned his desire to modify the Maxwell equations. So is that why some of his students actually worked on this nonlinear electrodynamics, like Bonenfeld theory and stuff like that? Or is it somehow connected to Einstein's idea?
I don't know. I mean, but his unified field theory was definitely going to include electromagnetism if he could get it to work. And it was going to be nonlinear, like GR, I assume. So I think that's probably why. But as my best guess is that he was looking for like soliton-like solutions between 1908 and 1910, you know, which is a big branch of modern, classical wave physics, classical electromagnetism, sort of, you know, these nonlinear particle-like solutions of the wave equation.
There's some snacks downstairs in the first floor bistro where we can have some questions. Yeah, let's check again.